We spend our life until we're 20, deciding what parts of ourself to put into the bag. That's the long bag that we drag behind us. And we spend the rest of our lives trying to get those things out again.
I hope you don't mind me saying this. What a stupid existence.
Sounds like a scam, doesn't it?
You know, when you hear it described like that, life described like that, like how do we fall into that trap?
I was missing out on a lot of the light and shade in life.
Yeah.
That our society really values being very successful. And I was successful and I never had to advertise myself. The work rolled in. And I was always grumbling to people that I had too much on my plate. But that also meant that I didn't have any space to do other things. And now I started to realise the incredible depth and satisfaction of having more time and space. Make sure I have joy every day.
Yeah.
And that might be as simple as a glass of red wine and a chocolate before I go to bed.
I love it, yeah.
Or it might just be a great conversation I have with people like you, or it might be reading a very satisfying book, or it might be actually going on an outing with people.
Sure.
So, but yeah. we've got to lighten up.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that I'm Australian. But I belong inside, I belong to a world community.
You know what? I knew you were going to say that.
Did you?
I did. It was like an ESP.
Telepathy.
Why is it what's the value of thinking that way?
Because there's can be a real arrogance, like I think all nationalities can become extremely jingoistic in just supporting themselves.
Yeah.
You know, here's the T-shirt. I'm this nationality, and so I'm not allowed to really say anything against my country.
Mm.
We can all be better.
Mm.
And we're all human beings.
Excitement, 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 dear listeners, and I haven't used that term for quite a few episodes. Have I used Chip Lachlan Huddy?
At least two and a half episodes since we've used that.
And I apologise to you right up front, mate. Guess what? I used Chip first.
But if you don't do that, then I feel like there's something wrong now, Boone. That's why we need to
Lachlan,
roll with it.
Chip Huddy.
There you go.
Hey, Chip, we've got a right to be excited today.
I'm pumped.
I'm going to give you two words. Here it is. Ready? Hillary Langford.
What a beautiful name.
She's in the studio, mate. She's in the studio.
I know. She's right here. I can almost smell it.
Well, Hillary, that's because ever since I met you, and let's right up front thank our mutual mate, Tony Groom. Might I add, Tony, episode number 3, Nature is Home. He was the one, Hillary, and you're going to laugh at this, who suggested that all politicians, in order to become in contact and connect with the people, need to roam naked through Leamington National Park.
Now,
does that
bold.
Sound like Tony?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're always talking about boldness, aren't we, Boone? That's bold.
Oh, you got to love Tony Groom. What a terrific man, of course, responsible in some way for the terrific Leamington National Park that is part of our Southeast Queensland corner, and also, of course, Binnaburra.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You might be a member of Binnaburra, are you? A subscriber?
No, but I've been up there many times,
yes.
And I've walked with Tony.
Yes.
Well,
we thank Tony because our contact is because of that great man.
Yeah.
And with a little smile on my face, you're obviously good mates because I'm looking at, shall I just say, similar stage of life?
Yes.
Now, the only reason...
That was nice and diplomatic, wasn't it?
Had no go, Chip, all
right? Yeah, well done. That was smooth.
The only reason is because when we understand that Hillary, in her mid-70s, there or thereabouts, dear people, we've got to understand then the experience and the wisdom that this particular woman has collected in her life. And when you hear her life story, we understand why the wisdoms have landed in her lap. And I'm so excited about taking, can I say this please, full advantage of your wisdoms that I know that you've got to offer. But Hillary, please start today by giving us an up to date. What are you doing these days? Because I know that life is not stopping for you. It's very full on.
Well, I've pulled back from my corporate work in the last 5 or so years.
5 years? I was going to say 5 months.
And I've got a whole lot of things that I spend time doing. Like I go to the gym every morning.
Well done.
And yeah. I'm part of the Queensland Irish Choir.
Wow.
And I have a network of some wonderful friends, but I'm also involved in the Enneagram Prison Project.
Yeah, but you've got me in that Queensland Irish Choir because
his last name is O'Kelly.
Kelly? O'Kelly. O'Kelly. What does that look like?
Oh, it looks like mainly a whole lot of old people who sing absolutely wonderful Irish songs, but also we sing Scottish and Welsh songs and some Australian songs and even some from places like Canada where Irish people have emigrated to.
Right. So you do your own version of Danny Boy?
Of course.
Wild Mountain Time?
Yes.
I love that. I just adore that song.
I promise you it won't go any more than 5 seconds, but I'm going to lead. Danny Boy.
The pipes are calling.
I am so grateful you came in there because I thought
that's all you got.
I thought there was going to be prolonged silence because they're the only words I know.
And you didn't give me a chance to do a singing warm-up, so I almost wasn't going to sing.
Yeah, but our listeners got a fair version there. Hey, how wonderful that you're still involved in something so beautiful. Hey, comment to us, please. What's the benefit and the value of you being involved in choir?
Well, firstly, it's just a lovely network of people.
Yeah.
But I've always been interested in music. I came from a family where, whether we wanted to or not, we all learned a musical instrument. And so music has been there all through my life.
Yeah.
But I didn't ever have time when I was busy in corporate work.
Hey, that's interesting. What exactly did you come to value that you hadn't valued before when your health put you into a place where you had to do other things? It made you almost leave behind the corporate for a while. You thought you were going back to it, but all of a sudden these other things came into your life and you started to realize something. What was it that you valued in these other things?
I was missing out on a lot of the light and shade in life.
Yeah.
That our society really values being very successful.
Mm.
And I was successful and I never had to advertise myself. The work rolled in. And I was always grumbling to people that I had too much on my plate. But that also meant that I didn't have any space to do other things. And now I started to realize the incredible depth and satisfaction of having more time and space and being able to spend more time looking after my physical body, expanding more into understanding more about my emotional body and my emotions, I should think, which is more the heart than the body. And beginning to just taste everything else that life had to offer.
Yeah, yeah.
I was too unidimensional. I became multidimensional.
If you didn't, sorry, the chipster.
And were those multi dimensions as satisfying as the satisfaction derived from success to you, or more so, or where, how would you rate that?
Different. Because I'm really, really pleased that I've been lucky to have a career which has enhanced people's lives as well as my own. And I come from a hardworking family, and we had working hard as drummed into us. But it was like I was able to give myself permission to have me time. I could stop helping the world for a while, and I could start saying, yep, it's time for me to have some fun.
Yeah. Hillary, this podcast, and Chip, you're allowed to intervene here. I think in 63 or 64 episodes, whatever it is, I would suggest that one of the things that we've learned is the value of space over busyness. And I would like to throw into the studio that throughout our life, we actually needed to learn to value space rather than busyness. It's so easy to say, oh, no, the busyness belongs to the lot of the 20s and the 30s and the 40-year-olds because we're supposed to be building empires, we're supposed to be following society's paradigms of success, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I would now advocate that in teaching people to value space is to give them opportunity to reflect and reevaluate. And in that reflection and reevaluate, actually come up with better vision for their busyness. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I would agree because I think it gives us a chance to separate out from society's demands.
Yeah.
Or in my case, also my family's demands. My mother believed we should be busy all the time. So even when we were sick as kids, she'd sit us up on pillows in our sick bed with a tray in front of us, and we'd be expected to write stories and poems and art and things like that so that we weren't wasting time.
Yeah.
And wasting time is a wonderful thing.
A chip. Are you hearing the phrase modified existence?
It may have occurred to me. It may have occurred to me. And I would just add to that, it's really just a tweak on what Hillary is saying, just the power of boredom. You know, like we've got a world now where you never need to be bored.
Yeah.
And we've lost sight of how valuable boredom is.
Yeah.
And the ideas that pop up.
Exactly.
In fact, I've got a quote here which talks about how we're framed by society, and it goes, we spend our life until we're 20 deciding which parts to put of ourselves into the bag. And that's all this getting rid of all this fun stuff and putting away all of that so that we start being a good focused person to make money, and then we spend the rest of our lives trying to get them out again. So all those interesting things that we put away, the fun things, I'm in the stage of I'm emptying out my bag and shaking it out.
I hope you don't mind. I'm going to get you to repeat that again.
Okay, I'll read it out because then I'll get the words exactly right.
Yeah.
We spend our life until we're 20 deciding what parts of ourself to put into the bag. That's the long bag that we drag behind us. And we spend the rest of our lives trying to get those things out again.
G'day, my splendid scrub turkeys rooting through the underbrush of introspection, and it's Chip here. And forgive my interruption, but I couldn't let that thought pass without inserting another of my loaded questions. And this one, I'll confess, isn't exactly mine. This one comes as a suggestion from Mr. Bernie Kelly himself. And Bern always helps me out with suggestions for loaded questions, but sometimes those suggestions are just too good to edit. So here's Bernie's loaded question. What if we were putting the right things into our bag of success from the very start? What if the things we were putting into the bag were meditation, time with nature, letting go of our ego, finding our true selves? What if these were the items that parents and teachers and friends and community taught us to put into our bags of success from birth. What kind of a difference do you reckon that would make?
We know why we fall into that trap.
We know why, because we're trying to get approval.
Getting
approval from parents, getting approval from teachers, getting approval from bosses, getting approval from our team, the harder we work. Certainly in my case, getting approval from my husband, because we were in business together, and if I was working hard and he was working hard, we were fine, except that we weren't really sometimes because we were burning ourselves out.
Yeah. But, of course, those people who you said we wanted their approval, they had to get approval too.
Exactly.
And so it appeared to me if we read a book like Sapiens, and I've forgotten his great name, but that incredible book of the history of
humanity. Yuval Noah Harari.
Thank you, Chip. That's why you're here, Chip. Give us his name again, please.
Yuval Noah Harari.
Yeah,
he's an Israeli. Anthropologist, I think.
He beautifully describes the evolutionary mind and how it's created this paradigm. But he also described the opportunities that we had as an evolving race, maybe not to have gone down that pathway. And yet somehow we did. And consequently, this is the world. Particularly talking about the Western world that we live in. And now I'm just hearing modify your existence. How this can't be the only way.
And yet we've benefited enormously because of this. I mean, the fact that I had my open heart surgery and the surgeons knew what to do and how to do it and do it excellently, probably because they had lived a life of very little wasted time, life of learning, a life of experience, and here I am, you know.
Exactly. And that's why we say modified. We don't want to just toss everything out because there's this beauty here.
Yeah.
There's amazing, incredible achievements here.
Yeah.
And they're worth giving credit to.
Yeah.
But there are some things worth modifying.
Yeah, but no, thank you for the backhander there because...
you love a backhander.
No, I do. I do love a backhander, particularly one that's got so much truth to it. And no, we're not saying let's turn our backs on it, but... we're just two average guys who happen to think there might be a better way.
Getting a very clear picture that there's a better way.
You swore at me before. What was that word that you used? Any a what?
Enneagram.
Yeah. what swear word is that? Is that Irish? Is that Scottish? Where does that come from?
Well, Ennea is actually the Greek word for nine.
Okay.
And gram just means a picture.
Okay.
Mm.
And it's a way... of identifying the patterns that we have. And firstly, we're all born with this beautiful inner gem. Some people call it the soul, some people talk about essence, some people talk about the inner light. But we're born with this beautiful quality. But the people around us start modifying our behavior. So we have to start putting protections over that so that we can instead focus on what others are seeking from us.
Okay.
So that we can get love and survive.
Yeah.
So in a way, I develop a pattern of this compulsive looking after behavior rather than letting that inner core just flow out.
That's true.
Because I am love. I'm not type two. Type two is like a mantle that I put on.
Yeah.
But inside, and this is one of the things in the prison project, when we teach the Enneagram to people in jail, they've been spent, most of their life they've been told what's wrong with you.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be doing this. Right from when they were children and then at school or police or the wardens or whatever, it's what's wrong with you.
Yeah.
Whereas we help people identify again what goes right back into that source. Who are they?
Yeah. Did you hear our episode with Nathan Flynn?
No, I didn't.
Wow, that's amazing because you're almost describing precisely what his journey was.
Right. Yeah?
But how he discovered, he didn't do an Enneagram, how he discovered, I believe, or got in touch with his core, as you call it, was a university student came for an assignment in prison while he had a 9-year sentence, a bikie gang member. And he only finished up spending 5 years in jail, but that university student became a love interest of his and vice versa. And so when the assignment was over, after four weeks, they started writing love letters. And he described how he had the opportunity to spend a whole day writing a 4-page love letter, and it made him dig down deep into what exactly he wanted to say. Yes. And so he became very, very, very good at picking exactly the right word and expressing exactly the right emotion through words. And I would imagine that too became a process for him to dig past those masks and facades or patterns to be able to discover a little bit of core.
And that's a beautiful story. And there are many paths up the mountain. One of the things our incarcerated people do is they write their biography as part of the program.
That's fascinating.
For the first 20 years of their life, they write that. And then we, as guides, write a response, and they start to put together all the pieces as to why I ended up where I am, which means that when they leave jail, they have a lot more options, a lot more choices, because now they can actually think about, I don't need to be in that old pattern again. I can expand out of that.
Awareness.
Nathan spoke about that too. He spoke about how easy it was to be drawn back to the world that he knew. But I think you're now saying the world that his patterns were comfortable in.
Where he could. It was familiar. It was a familiar place. But it was a familiar place that would take him back and back and back.
So ultimately, it's a tool for us to recognize our program and our conditioning. And to become so aware of our program and conditioning that rather than allow it just to drive us towards the normal outcome, the usual outcomes, we can actually choose a different pathway and different outcome.
Is that, I find that incredible, like the power of awareness, and it just, everything seems to begin with that. And what is it, do you think, about becoming self-aware that allows you to become that much more connected with other people? Because that's what you saw.
Well, when you're trying to be very present, that's when you become more self-aware. So instead of your mind telling yourself stories about who I am or what I am or who you are or whatever, it's what's actually here now and what's with you here and now. And so we're getting an unedited version of ourselves. And we start all of our sessions with presencing type exercises. We're mindful and feeling our feet on the ground and becoming here and now. In fact, one of the guys in the group that I was working with, every so often he would be so present and he could feel the presence in the room and he'd just go, shit's got real. And it's my favorite phrase now.
Yeah, I love that.
Because it's when we're not editing and there's just that lovely flow between human beings.
But isn't it fascinating? Shit's got real. As if to say, we don't have enough experiences of being so real, so raw, so core, so open, that when we do, oh my God, this is a spooky place. This is this is shit got real.
This is running naked.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Tony Grimm is.
Oh, you good on your Tony. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, Tony. Yeah. You started this. Back in
there. But it is, there is a nakedness in it that, you know, I'm no longer trying to push an image.
Mm. As you said, it's the unedited self. And I think shit's got real. Okay, what we're experiencing there is like real life. That is the world as it is.
As it actually is.
Yeah, not the story that you've told around.
Telling ourselves.
Yeah, whatever you saw or experienced.
But how fortunate are you, Hilary, to be working with such a tool that not only enables you to be a catalyst of assistance for people, but also allows you to connect with people, feel people, understand people, therefore understand self. I mean, this is continuous growth for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Till the my last breath.
Yeah.
We never stop if we're still growing.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people, as we get older, sort of get stuck in the pattern.
Yeah.
And and then they sort of almost can implode on themselves.
Yeah.
Mm. And that remaining open is a challenge, and taking risks is a challenge. And
Have you found that you need to be more and more cognizant of that as you get older? Is there a less energy than you had, say, in your 20s or 30s to keep making these right decisions for yourself?
I think I've probably partly because I've had such a varied background. Mm. I think I'm a natural risk taker. Mm. I think physically I will eventually have less energy, but right now I've got plenty of energy.
Yeah.
In fact, I think I told you when we met before that when I went to see the heart surgeon, and they were telling me the issue that they had to try and correct with surgery. And the surgeon said, you've probably noticed you don't have nearly as much energy as most people around you. And I thought, no, I've always had a lot more energy.
Absolutely.
And as we were walking out the door, my late husband whispered to me, thank God you've got that heart condition.
Oh, that's a good line. Yeah. I like that one.
But I think that comes from being thrown initially, being an immigrant to Australia, being thrown into all sorts of other situations and learning that you do survive. And I think that helps you as a risk taker. Yeah. In fact, I've got my little list, which I think I told you.
I've got it down over here. Yeah. Yes, I can see it all here. Practicing gratitude.
Mm.
Eating well, exercising well, sleep well.
Yep.
Keep learning, love of learning.
Mm.
Do something meaningful. Elaborate.
Well, for me, that's what EPP is to have a meaningful contribution that I can make to the world. But for someone else, doing something meaningful might just be collecting their grandchild from school once a week and having that important grandparent-child relationship, which helps set up both the child, and they've discovered that grandparents who are actively involved with their grandchildren actually live longer lives.
Yeah.
So meaningfulness, or it might be to make a beautiful garden.
Yeah.
It's whatever's important to you.
Yeah.
For me, being a helper type two, I tend to go back to something that I feel I'm contributing to the world.
Enneagram prison project.
That's right. Have people who love me.
Yeah.
That's really important. But again, that doesn't – I mean, if my husband was still alive, it would be lovely to have the love from him.
Yeah.
But you can get love in many, many different ways. Yeah. And that might be as simple as a glass of red wine and a chocolate before I go to bed.
I love it,
Or it might just be a great conversation I have with people like you, or it might be reading a very satisfying book, or it might be actually going on an outing with people.
Sure.
So, we've got to lighten up.
Yeah.
And would you make the distinction between, say, a joyful task, and there's obviously a lot of overlap, and, say, a meaningful task. The joyful ones are the ones that you can keep light, you know, but if you're bringing that purpose and that meaning into it, that necessarily gets a little more serious.
Yeah, although they overlap so much. Like the choir for me is joy, particularly when we pull off a good concert. And our musical directors smiling at us, and us altos slap each other on the back and said we did good. There's a lot of joy in that, but there's also meaning in that, because we've connected as human beings, and we also know, you know, intellectually, we know that singing together is very, very good for the heart and the body and all the rest of it. But so, yes, but it's, for me, it's good to have a little checklist, because when I'm not doing one of those, any of those that I, if I drop out, life isn't as good.
And Chip, I sometimes people might say, "Oh, Bernie, you're so intense."
Yeah, do you get that?
I do get a little bit of that.
I can imagine.
And I look at them and go, "Well, guess what? I don't feel intense." I said, "Oh, yeah, but you're always talking and dissecting life." I said, "That's because I love it.
Yeah,
it brings me joy."
And there's your joy.
It's meaning and joy.
Absolutely. Yeah. It brings both. Hey, Chip, I don't know about you, but I'm in.
100%, mate. I'm sorry.
You don't even know what you're in for.
Yes.
I'm talking about the Enneagram.
I know, mate. Hey? I could guess. We've got the AJWB and C telepathy, and I knew.
Hillary, what about the prospect of Chip and I doing the Enneagram? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And let's come back for another episode down the track. And there would be some results, some discussion, some sharing, some shared process. And through that, we can teach people even more, one, about themselves, two, about humanity and people and those patterns. And in the process, we'll even take the risk they can learn a lot about us and our little core.
I'm sure they'd love to learn about it, because they keep getting little tastes of this.
And it sounds powerful.
It is. It's very powerful.
Yeah.
It can be life-changing.
And you would say, now, I think our listeners get the sense that you've done a lot in the self-development space and a lot of work on yourself. When we were talking off mic, you said the Enneagram is the most probably powerful framework you've come across.
It certainly was for me, because I've been fortunate in that my entire career has been involved with what makes people tick. And so I've learned a lot of the different ways in which, and all of them add some really useful things. But after a while, you'd think, yeah, but what about this and what about this? And then when I got the Enneagram and started reading my type, it was like, oh shit. there's nowhere to hide now.
Wow. Yeah.
And that is wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful.
It's bracing.
It's just so good. It's liberating.
Yeah.
It's liberating, because there were so many stories that I was telling myself about how I had to be.
And
it was like, that's only one of them. All these other buggers in the other eight types, they don't have to do all of this.
Yes.
Right, I'm not going to do all of this.
Yes.
I'm going to expand now. I'm going to try some other stuff.
Yeah. One of the other things of the Enneagram, this is my understanding, is it not only identifies your patterns and can I call it, in your normal life, also, there are patterns that arise different from normality when we're under stress and strain. So, in fact, it doesn't put us in one box. It doesn't give us one number, does it?
No, that's right. It does tell us what, once we've gone on the journey, and it's a journey to work out what your core type is. Mm. Once we've got that, when we're finding we're hit with something that our current type doesn't have enough resources to cope with, it can tell us, it can begin to suggest which other ways we might travel.
Yeah.
So it isn't just one box. In fact, one of my early teachers, David Daniels, used to say, the Enneagram doesn't put you in a box. It actually teaches you what box you're already in.
Yeah.
So that then you can expand out of that and make other choices.
Geez, I like that. Mm. I like the whole concept of expanding out of that because if we go into other practices like Vipassana meditation, you know, they keep on speaking about that the task is not to find love. It's not to become love. You already are. The task is to get rid of the interventions. It's to get rid of the distractions. It's to dilute the stuff that stops us from being core. It's almost a task of getting rid of rather than finding and discovering.
Yes, identifying the barriers and moving beyond them.
Yeah. Okay, we're in. We're in. So we can look forward to that episode somewhere down the track, but we're going to have an Enneagram featuring Chip and Bernie with Hillary as our co-facilitator. This will mean you're almost co-hosting the program.
Exactly.
She'll be hosting, mate.
You're
playing with your words. She's hosting. We're just here for the long.
You two haven't been, having a little few phone calls on the side over here.
You're jealous, mate.
This is not a mutiny, is it?
You need to have more than one crew member to have a mutiny. Mm-hmm.
Now, Hillary, if you don't mind, there is so much richness in your life that I would like to just go back in some of these milestones of your 70 plus years upon the planet. Was that the right way to say it?
Yep. I don't mind people knowing I'm 75.
There it is, right?
She just put it out there.
Like, for example, born 75 years ago, it was in India. You spent 7 years, your first 7 years of your life in India. Mm. And I could ask you, what was that like? I'm asking you to go back into a lot of memory there. I'm just going to ask you, how did spending the first 7 years of your life in India, how does that still impact you 68 years later?
Well, we emigrated to Australia. In fact, we were in Tasmania for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I can remember when we first hit Tasmania thinking how strange all of the Australian kids were who were in my class. I was in grade two. And I just remember thinking, this is really strange. And I can remember my thought thinking, and yet it seems to work for them. Because I was used to the way it was done in India. And it was actually quite a profound thought that I became aware of, is that different people do things in different ways and that's okay.
Mm.
It seems to work for them.
Yeah.
And so I think that's helped me in the whole way I view life.
Yeah.
And when I've done a lot of travel, I've been to seven continents.
Mm.
And wherever I go, I'm absolutely fascinated in finding out how does the way they live make sense for them and how does it seem to work for them?
Mm.
And all people are different and even different individuals are different and yet they make it work for them one way or another.
Do you, in the pathway of still trying to maximise life, maximise the life of Hillary Langford?
Yeah.
Do you sometimes look at, for example, the way of the Indian way of life and you have a look at the Australian way of life and you go, oh, there are elements of that that really add a lot of value. And there are some elements over here from the Australian way of life that adds a lot of value. Do you mix and match?
Probably not. I think I was probably too young to have brought enough over and I've lived 60 plus years in Australia, so I don't but I'll tell you when I notice it is when I fill out the forms when I'm traveling and I say I'm Australian and I love the fact that I'm Australian, but I belong inside, I belong to a world community.
You know what, I knew you were going to say that.
Did you?
I did. It was like an ESP.
Telepathy.
Why is it what's the value of thinking that way?
Because there's can be a real arrogance, like I think all nationalities can become extremely jingoistic in just supporting themselves.
Yeah.
You know, here's the T-shirt. I'm this nationality, and so I'm not allowed to really say anything against my country.
Mm.
We can all be better.
Mm.
And we're all human beings.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether I'm in a car with a driver in India or if I'm in a car with an African guide in Africa going into a safari or something like that, they're all talking about their kids and what they want for their kids. And they want their kids to be successful and happy and lead a good life and find the right partner.
Yeah.
We're all the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are universal values, aren't there?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You said something very interesting before that captured me and a little surprised me. Here it is. You said that you weren't sure that there was something after this life, and yet there was a reference early on, the reference early on through the Enneagram, that we are born core. So if we're born core, is there not an inference of what does that core represent?
Mm. That's such a good question.
Oh, good. Wow.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's and that's also the agnostic part of me, and it's like when we see these pictures of the galaxies and see how tiny our planet is in that huge galaxy and then how tiny we are in the whole scheme of things and how does that all hold together? And so for me, if I have a religion, it is probably like Tony Groom, nature.
Or, I'm with your sister.
For me, there's something about the universe and the universe holding us in the palm of her hand.
Yeah, mm. I love your answer because it's an answer to the question. The answer is you're agnostic. That is, you just don't know.
Mm.
You just don't know. I can honestly say I'm agnostic. I don't know. But I want to, in my current state, my current journey, decide on something. I still don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, life says I will decide that in my limited experiences of life, it's an ongoing journey, that my body will die.
Yes.
My mind will die.
Yeah.
It's already forgetting stuff.
Yeah. I'm with you on that.
But don't
where are we?
Don't question the youthfulness of my spirit. Mm. You know, I don't know. It doesn't appear to be dwindling very fast.
Yeah.
You know, so therefore, it seems to me to have longevity beyond certainly where I'm currently at. You know, and like you, I look to the stars and go, who, how, what?
It's extraordinary.
And then I hear from this podcast so many of our different guests talking about nature made that universe, but so did they make the tree beside us, and so did they make Chip Lachlan Huddy. So therefore, we're all in common with nature. Nature flows with us, through us, in us.
Mm.
You know, all of that type of stuff.
And we're just one of the animals on this planet.
Yeah, we are still animals.
Yeah.
Can I just jump in here with my two cents on that? Because I would describe myself as an atheist in principle, agnostic in practice, simply because you need to acknowledge the limits of human perception so you need to really know. We get hung up on knowing. I think a much more productive way of thinking, and I hope everyone can, you know, have a think about this. You don't need to know, but you should play the odds, you know. And the way we discover what those odds are is by examining the evidence. And I don't just mean dry scientific evidence.
Yeah.
I do mean there is a wealth of experience that seems to converge on universal human experiences, right? And they're worth listening to as well. We've talked about a lot of those.
It's like an engineering friend of mine when in the early stages of all the conversations about climate change, he said to me, well, he said, the way I see it is if we were to try and clean up the planet, that's not such a bad thing anyway, even if there's no climate change.
Exactly,
it'd
right.
It'd be a good thing to do.
Exactly. Good change, But I tell you what's a good thing to do. I'm going straight down to Ladbrokes. I'm going to find out what the odds are, and scientists discovered that, you know, there is an energy out there that we're all tapped into, because I tell you what, I need to boost my superannuation, mate, and I reckon. I think there well might be an opportunity
said,
there.
Well said. I think you might be onto something. I'm willing to throw my hat in the ring for some kind of universal connection. If that does exist, I would say, in my opinion, it will turn out to be no less natural than wind or gravity or any other element. It's simply we are so far away from an understanding of it that it appears to us like magic. I don't think it will be. I think nature is majestic enough to encompass something like that.
Chip, you finally got that off your chest.
I've been working up to it.
By the way, I love it because guess what? That's a different definition than what we've heard before.
But I don't think it's incompatible with anyone else's, you know, particular spiritual pathway. I really don't.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, except where it's a bit different, Chip, is the simplicity of it. You just said that it might be as simple as, what did you say, wind and
gravity.
And, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas when we talk about spirit or source greater than self, we're thinking of a fairly colossal power out there, you know.
I see what you mean. I suppose I just see that in the natural world.
Yeah.
You know, that I genuinely can feel in that much awe of the natural world.
G'day, my majestic mongooses frolicking over the pasture land of inner progress. It's Chip again, and I couldn't let that thought pass without inserting yet another of my loaded questions, and this one's going to be very personal. Personal for me, certainly, because I'm keying off myself here and my thoughts on the majesty of nature, but personal for you as well, I hope, because I want to get you thinking about your own mindset around the natural versus the supernatural, because wherever you land on this, it's always valuable to engage in a bit of self-reflection on these big topics. So here's the question. Two-parter. I like my two-parters. First part. When you think about our universe, its vastness, its majesty, its mystery, do you, like me, see in that mystery a grand system of natural laws that might have the appearance of the supernatural, but is only the natural world not yet properly understood by the human mind? Or do you see in that mystery evidence of the supernatural? Do you see the hand of God? Do you see the will of Allah? Do you see the creative work of Brahma and the maintenance of Vishnu? Do you see something that is not all nature? So, second part of the question, if you do see the supernatural, why must you see it? What makes that story the more beautiful, compelling, meaningful story? Why do we need the supernatural?
But the natural world also has tiny little bits of power when you look at the ecosystems, and yet they're really, really important. That's not the big power. There's the little power. So is power a human concept?
Yeah, I think so, in the way that you're talking about it, absolutely. But I would also say there's little tiny bits of power. If you're putting all of those together and suggesting that they're linked, and I think everything is linked, like cosmically, then all of those little bits of power put together are going to produce something pretty colossal.
Yeah. Well, I think they are connected because they all belong to nature. You called it the cosmos before. Hey, you know what? We've spent so much time on this podcast already. I think we need to start thinking about winding it up. But I'm not going to wind it up unless we refer to a segment in this bio that you've given us, Hilary, that I think is just beautiful. And I hope you don't mind me referring to the loves of your life.
Oh, the loves of my life.
Yeah. It says relationships down there.
Whereabouts?
And you've had two.
Which one are you referring to?
Just here.
Oh, okay, yes, yep.
The relationships of your life. And we could dwell upon the fact that you've been married twice, and that's interesting. Three times? Wasn't the one in the middle was really – did you get married? Mm. Oh, okay. She had three. Congratulations. Well done. But the one in the middle was the love of your life.
Mm.
And I've read, I think you actually said it earlier on. You said, had your marriage to Ian persisted, and unfortunately it was taken away from you through his passing, things would be different now. What made the love with Ian so different than your two other experiences of marriage?
Well,
you don't mind me asking?
No, not at all. Yeah. Not at all. I had been married to somebody and we had two sons and I divorced. And the process of separating and then divorcing was long and drawn out for all sorts of reasons, but certainly partly because I felt so bad. And I felt that we needed to stay together because of the kids. And the more I worked on myself and the more I thought about it, it got to the stage where I wasn't able to stay with him any longer.
Yeah.
And so I decided that I was never going to get married again.
Yeah.
Because that was definitely men were just too difficult.
Yeah.
And then I met Ian Oliver. And, in fact, he invited me out and I'd been a bit of a hermit for quite a while. And so it seemed nice to be going to be going out. But then between the phone call and him arriving at the front door, I panicked because I thought, I shouldn't be doing this. I'm not going to get married. So I greeted him.
You're saying that in the first date, you're already thinking that this could be a pathway to marriage?
Well, that's what dating is.
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree with that. I mean, it's always in the back of your head. Yeah.
But picture this. I lived in a house in Auchenflower in Brisbane, and it was 32 steps up to the front door.
Yeah.
And I had a Doberman. And when there was a knock on the door, Crikey. When there was a knock on the door, and she went leaping out, going woo 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 woo, like a Doberman does.
Yeah.
What I didn't know was he was phobic of dogs.
Right.
And so I opened the door. He's still on this two steps down from the door. I opened the door, but my hands on her collar, and she got raised up onto her back legs.
It's a lot of dog.
That's a lot of dog, and he's two steps down. And I'm not thinking about the impact of that. I'm just worried that he's going to get the wrong idea.
Okay.
And so I just said to him, look, just before we go out, it's really nice, the thought of going out and having dinner or going out with someone, but I have no intention of having a relationship. Yeah. You do know that, don't you?
Yeah.
And he said at that stage, all he could see was this dog. And it was like, yes, anything at all.
It's perfectly okay.
It's like you've got a gun on you.
And so, but as we went out and as we started talking, we were so in sync, but from totally different ways. His background was in technology and economics and statistics, but he'd also started doing quite a lot of personal growth because he'd been married for 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'd been working on himself as to why that happened, just as I'd been working on myself as to why mine had happened.
Mm.
And we were both on that path, which meant whenever anything came up that was of difficulty or conflict, we would sit down and we would talk it through. And sometimes it might take over several days. It was hard work being with him.
Yeah.
But there was nothing ever underneath the carpet. Whereas with my first marriage, I think we'd both been taught by our families that If you don't have any conflict, it's probably a good relationship.
Yeah.
But in fact, there was so much stuff under the carpet and we couldn't ever get it out. But with him, there was never anything. So that openness that we talked about, that fact that we didn't edit what we were saying to each other, we absolutely spoke our truth.
Yeah.
And that meant it also was quite a tumultuous relationship at times.
Yeah.
But it was so pure.
Mm.
And it was he was a wonderful companion, and he absolutely trusted me in my abilities and who I was, just as I absolutely trusted him, who he was and his abilities. And so we worked together too for quite a lot of that time. Yeah. We co-led many things and it just worked absolutely like clockwork.
Yeah.
And it was successful professionally and very successful in our relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you were working with what was actually there, not whatever veneer we toss up for approval.
Yes, and we would go and talk about those stories as well. So in a lot of ways, the relationship I had with my father was a very distant one as far as he was concerned. And so I almost felt like I hadn't been fathered. And he also had a very distant relationship with his mother. So in a lot of ways, we parented each other. We partnered each other. We grew together. We worked together. We grew each other up.
Wow.
As well as being lovers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm hearing so much here.
Yeah, that's
so
amazing.
Much here. Mm. You used the word before, pure.
Yeah.
But that's the same meaning as raw.
Yes.
It was totally raw, which means, of course, that offers the opportunity for total raw acceptance.
Yes, which sometimes took a while to get to.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't easy. It was because neither of us had learnt how to do this. I mean, he came from a family where his father was pretty dominant.
Yeah.
I came from a family where my mother was pretty dominant. Neither of the families had open and clear communication. In fact, if you think about it, when we look around, where are the role models that we have of really good relationships and really good conflict resolution? You know, we see, like, our legal system tends to be win-lose. Most arguments are about win-lose.
Yeah.
Politicians are about win-lose.
Yeah.
Myths and mythology.
Yes.
Win-lose.
Yeah. And so when we go to court, it's win-lose. And so we had to sort of make it up as we went along. The fact that he was doing a PhD, though, that was to measure the amount of mutual understanding between people.
And that was the subject of his PhD?
Yeah, which I which I found out there. About which I found out about in that very first dinner.
You were his subject matter.
We were. In fact, he kept testing the process he was developing on us to see how much mutual understanding we had.
Oh,
That was fairly challenging.
Right, so you were part of the experiment, part of the research.
Yes.
And you were game. I love that. Yeah. You just jumped in.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
But we'd both been doing personal growth stuff and I had been, so it was,
Why did he take you by surprise so much on that first date? Like you made it clear. You got the Doberman there. You made it clear you're not interested. There won't be a second date. We're not progressing here. And yet, what was it that enabled two people to find a bit of yin and yang?
Maybe it's because by saying that, I allowed the barriers to come down.
Wow, that's a bit of self-awareness.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, that's probably quite true.
Yeah.
Because certainly after that night, there was no other.
Yeah.
That just started a 2-decade-plus relationship.
That is amazing. That is amazing. I just learned something. So for all those women that I date who say to me they're not interested in a relationship, I can interpret that as that they are.
Oh, here we go.
Well, you can.
What a message to take away from this conversation.
Thank you, Hillary. Oh, Hillary Langford, have you enjoyed this?
I have. It's been a lot of fun. And quite challenging, too.
Oh, that's good. And I'm glad it's challenging. It's not meant that we don't intend it to be that way, of course, but that it is can make it also a little bit therapeutic. And I don't mean that that's our purpose at all, but if it's challenging, it can also promote rethinking, reevaluation, you know, for all of us, you know, here, you know, by the way.
Mm.
Yeah. So thank you ever so much. I'm so looking forward to the next episode where we're going to focus on the Enneagram and looking forward to you hosting that episode of A Journey with Bernie. Chip, we're going to have to talk about this. In which Chip and I will be the subject. Is that the right word? The focus of the learning and discovering from that episode through your great facilitation. Yeah. Hillary Langford, you have been a part of. I've forgotten what episode it is, so we won't worry about the number. But it's less than your age.
Well played.
You've been part of A Journey with Bernie and
Chip.
We do hope you enjoyed this particular episode, dear people. Thank you for being a part of our journey. And we cannot wait to meet you again in 1 week's time. It'll be Friday, 3 p.m. if you live in Australia. And if you're anywhere else around the world, just find out what is.
Just figure it out. Plug it in.
The same time in Brisbane.
Yeah.
Cheers, dear people. Take care.
Thanks, Bern. Thank you so much, Hillary. And thank you, listeners, you spiffy swans on the cold, clear surface of Introspection Pond. Thank you for staying with us for yet another edition of Chip's Take Home Pay and joining me, Chip Lachlan Huddy, as I try to pull together the most impactful themes of the podcast you just listened to and offer some hard, fast, concrete action steps so that you can start applying the wisdom of our guests to your own life, not next week, not tomorrow, but right now and today. I think it's obvious, isn't it? I think we need to talk about the Enneagram. Now, I want to address a potential elephant in the room before we go any further, and that elephant is this. You will be able to find some reputable scientific folks who'll tell you that the Enneagram as a personality typing system is pseudoscience. It's not really proven. Now, once upon a time, that might have bothered me, which is, funnily enough, exactly what you'd expect from someone with my Enneagram type. But these days, I understand that you'll always be able to find reputable scientific folks to criticize any idea. That is the world we have. And if that bothers you, then fine, I get it. No hard feelings. You can go ahead and skip today's take-home pay. But if you do skip it, please bear this in mind. Speaking from my own experience of the Enneagram system itself, my experience of Hillary as a practitioner, and of my own reflection on my Enneagram experience as a whole, I personally think that there's a lot of value to be gleaned from the Enneagram, and it is absolutely worth your time. Okay, still with me? Let's proceed. Now, like any personality typing system, and like Hillary said, you do want to approach the Enneagram with the right frame of mind. Learning your type isn't about putting you into a box. It's about making you aware of the box you're already in. Now, that's a powerful idea on which it's worth lingering, because I think too often we approach the project of self-development simply in terms of addition, right? In terms of adding skills, in terms of building ourselves up. And that's certainly how I used to think of it anyway. But we're missing a trick if we take that view alone, because it neglects consideration of what we're already working with and how that might affect our development going forward. Simple idea, but very powerful. And that's why this idea of awareness, and you might have heard us mention that word on the podcast more than once by now, that's why this idea of awareness is so important, because yes, one means of development is building new structures, but another, just as powerful, maybe even more powerful, is shoring up the existing structure, learning how to better work with and navigate what is already there. And none of that can happen without awareness of the existing structure. Now, there are many paths to awareness, and we talk about them often, meditation, mindfulness, journaling, and I see the Enneagram as another tool toward that awareness. But what makes the Enneagram particularly powerful is that its barrier to entry is lower compared to those other forms of awareness raising. Your first Enneagram test could take as little as 15 minutes, and it also gives you very clear, very immediate feedback. That's the nature of a test, and I'm not dumping on meditation or mindfulness or journaling, but they do require a certain amount of motivation to get going and to keep going. But taking a simple test, well, that's kind of fun, isn't it? So it doesn't take much to get going. And if you use your results intelligently, if you understand that it isn't about imposing barriers on you, but about making you aware of patterns that are already in place, if you use that little thrill of discovery as a springboard to propel you into deeper investigation of your Enneagram type, say by reading a book or taking a course, then I call that mission accomplished. And I absolutely invite you to accept that mission. Use the Enneagram test as the spark that kindles a bonfire of self-awareness. So here's the action step, and we'll put the link in the show notes. So go to truity.com/test/Enneagram-personality-test-paged. One more time, go to truity, that is truity.com/test/Enneagram. That is E-N-N for November, E-A-G for golf, R for Roger, A for alpha, M for mustache, /personality-test-paged. truity.com/test/Enneagram-personality-test-paged. I hope you got all that, because I am not going again. Now, you want to take the test on that page, take you about 15, 20 minutes. You will have to pay for the full report, but it's going to give you your type for free. And then you can do your own research around your type if you really don't want to pay for their full report. But I would encourage you to pay for something, because then you have skin in the game and the results are always a little better, always a little smoother when there's skin in the game. But before you get too deep in the weeds of your Enneagram type, why don't you go to the comments section of this episode on the A Journey with Bernie and Chip website and tell us what your type is. Head over to journeywithbernie.co, that's .co, not .com, journeywithbernie.co, find episode 71 in the podcast section, and let us know your Enneagram type. We'd really appreciate it. And speaking of what we'd appreciate, you'd better believe we'd appreciate a rating and review of the show on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. 5 stars is best for the algorithm, but you go ahead and give us whatever you think is right. We trust you, you silky, silky swans. All right, that's all from me, beautiful people. I'm Chip Huddy. This has been Chip's Take Home Pay, and I do hope you found some pay worth taking home. As always, my friends, auf Wiedersehen, and just remember...